What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Nozomi Hayese is the author of WikiLeaks, The Global Fourth Estate, History is Happening, which recounts the rise of the whistleblowing site since its public prominence in 2010 and its subsequent years of publishing. From the clash with the US State Department and the prosecution of Julian Assange to controversies surrounding the publication of the John Podesta emails, this book traces the challenges that WikiLeaks has faced in its mission to bring the First Amendment to the world. Nozomi is trained as a liberation psychologist, deeply steeped in the tradition of depth psychology, humanetics, and phenomenology. She is a frequent guest at Kaiser Report and writer for the Bitcoin magazine. Nozomi, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing great, thank you.
Sure, I'm super excited to talk to you. Kind of what we were talking about before the show is, you know, I came across you in January and these topics that you've written on were so interesting to me, and I was hoping to be able to speak right away. But when I looked at how much you've written and the depth of your articles and your book, I really need more time to center up for this conversation. So it's great to have you here. You know, I guess to start off, what is a liberation psychologist?
Okay, so liberation psychology is one that was created by Spanish Jesuit priest, Ignacio Martin Barro. And he lived in El Salvador, but he studied psychology in Chicago in the USA. And when he actually went back to El Salvador and tried to apply his knowledge to what he learned to understand his people there down there, he recognized that psychology that he learned in the West doesn't quite explain or is not going to help his people. So he kind of started to recognize that the dominant, you know, mainstream psychology kind of promotes the certain kind of universality, the sort of universal view of man that is very much one-sided, and try to apply that to understand everyone basically. So liberation psychology is in many ways, it's a revolt against this mainstream psychology, revolt against this orthodoxy knowledge of psychology that try to define people based on the statistical norm of man. So that's kind of like the basic background of how liberation psychology has been developed. But how I see it is that, you know, in every kind of, disciplines, whether it's engineering or chemistry or biology, there is a central dogma in these studies in science. And psychology, of course, has also central dogma. And for psychology, it's a kind of way of looking at men based on the behaviorism or a reductionist approach that trying to kind of denies that there is something innate within us, you know, that each person is born with this unique individual character, but instead that, you know, that we are born here being completely blank, so that, you know, there have to be a society or external forces that would mold us into becoming, you know, who we should be. So that central dogma of kind of a rejection of individuality, rejection of kind of what gives us dignity of the humans. So that was the center dogma, and then liberation psychology basically said, wait a minute, you know, that's not what human being is. Human beings means that we have dignity, we have freedom, that we are, you know, we each person has this something unique, something that cannot be deduced to being labeled, cannot be deduced to be defined or fixed. So that's kind of, you know, I would say liberation psychologists are liberians, you know, dissident who, you know, quite could not fit in to the discourse of the mainstream psychology. And that's kind of like how I kind of found resonance with Bitcoin community, as a matter of fact, because Bitcoiners really challenged the status quo and they try to think outside of the box. And then I find that you know, liberation psychology, me studying liberation psychology really helped me, prepared me to understand Bitcoin and be a part of Bitcoin community in a sense.
Yeah, it sounds like liberation psychology is the psychosis of Bitcoin, or the ethos right. of it. I kind of want to explore it more. One of the reasons I kind of really want to get more into psychology and what you've learned and your background and experience is because it seems like knowledge of psychology can be used to move public opinion.
Definitely, definitely. And I don't know if you know, if you are familiar with Edward Bernays and, you know, what he created, you know, he's understood as a father of public relations, and he created the, you know, what we now understand as propaganda. Are you familiar with Edward Bernays?
No.
He is actually, he studied, he's a Sigmund Freud nephew. And Sigmund Freud is a well-known psychoanalyst, you know, the depth psychologist. He was a teacher of Carl Jung, for instance. And, you know Freud, right?
Yes.
And you have heard of Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
So
yes.
Edward Bernays, you know, studied his uncle's theory of the unconscious. So that there's, you know, Freud put forward this idea that there is something that we don't know, that there's a part of us that is unknown to us. And he termed that as unconscious, right? So, and because that that part of ourselves, you know, is unconscious desires, you know, the impulses, the things that motivate us, you know, and if when that material, so to speak, you know, is not known to us, then, you know, by, and you know, people studying about it and try to understand it, they can maybe manipulate, they can use that unconscious desires to make people to act in a certain way. So Edward Bernays basically studied Sigmund Freud's theory of unconscious and then created, applied that knowledge to create public relations, the mechanism of public relations. And then, you know, he successfully, example of application of this is, you know, he worked with tobacco companies, for instance, and then made women smoke, you know, or, you know, kind of promoted that smoking is a cool thing. And women who didn't have any inclination to drink, to smoke, were kind of, you know, manipulated into smoking. And then that, this mechanism of PR, of course, is used to promote war. So it became a big part of politics, basically, how politicians use that mechanism to make, not only, you know, make citizens to vote for the candidates that they want, but also basically engineer and manufacture public consent, you know, making them to consent to something that they would be against if they're informed well. So it's kind of like a manipulation tactics in a very sophisticated way. Yeah.
Sure. I kind of want to dig a little bit into, go back to 2010 in April. There was a typical spring day in San Francisco. The world we knew was about to change. WikiLeaks published collateral murder. And I'd like to discuss that within the framework of the effects WikiLeaks has had on the stadium of democracy. And Yeah, and how that video changed things for the internet and for
I mean, obviously,
democracy.
I mean, okay, so many of us know WikiLeaks or got to know about WikiLeaks in 2010 when WikiLeaks published the material, the Colorado Matter video. And before then, you know, the organization was really unknown. Nobody knew about it, right? But what was amazing is that WikiLeaks was able to actually reveal, you know, expose this classified military video that depicted the US military gunning down innocent civilians, including children and Reuters journalists, right? And that video, that little material was kept secret because the US government classified it. And then Reuters journalists actually tried to obtain the material by using Freedom of Information Act, and it was denied. And then it was only by WikiLeaks releasing the material in 2010 that we were able to actually see what has happened on that crucial day. And it was very shocked. I mean, it was very sensational. I mean, it's you know, because I was in US at the time, and this was the time that I think for American public, since the Vietnam War, that I think American people have not seen the real, you know, the role image of war, you know, what war looks like, right? And as I understand, during 60s, during Vietnam War, that American public was still able to see, you know, dead soldiers coming back from Vietnam. And so because the media wasn't quite sensitive at that time. So, you know, this was kind of shocking. I think it really sensationalized public and it shocked American people. And it was a global phenomena because, you know, WikiLeaks released the material on the internet. And so that, of course, you know, journalists were very excited about this publication because WikiLeaks was able to publish materials that no other media have ever done. You know, all the media have ever, you know, more than, you know, they have published more materials than all the media have combined, right? But for me, as an ordinary person looking in, you know, really that publication changed my life because I recognized the power of the internet, that WikiLeaks really demonstrated, you know, in revolutionary power with the internet. And that if it is unleashed, if this power of the internet is brought to the hands of ordinary people, what it can do. And of course, you know, it was not just this publication, but the effect of the publication, how WikiLeaks disclosure empowered the people around the world, and it sparked the global uprising, you know, from Tunisia, Egypt, Spanish, you know, Indigenado movement. And of course, as you probably experienced, you know, you were part of it too, the Occupy movement in the United States. And then we had, you know, this was the largest social movement ever, right, in the US. And it was kind of like global. So so then, you know, that really profoundly changed me. And at that time I was studying liberation psychology and then, you know, and wanted to kind of find a way to use knowledge of liberation psychology to promote social change at the time. And then when I saw WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks this sensational debut and what it did in terms of, you know, WikiLeaks as a cultural phenomena, that kind of made me, you know, almost wanted to quit studying, quit, you know, being in academia, just leave academia and want to be a part of this growth, you know, internet culture, so to speak. So from that time, I basically wanted to understand what makes WikiLeaks resilient. You know, how could this organization be able to do what it did? So that kind of led me to study Julian Assange's philosophy and led me to the philosophy of psychopunks.
Sure. I'd love to hear more about Julian Assange's philosophy. Mm-hmm. I remember growing up in the first Gulf War, aiding or supporting your point earlier was that we did see a lot of imagery from the war. I remember coming home from school every day and we saw mm-hmm. a lot of footage from the war, but it was to support what you were saying. It was very clean. It was, everything was one shot blowing up a building with no collateral damage, no one getting hurt. Everything was like, looked like a video game. And I almost think that was used to manipulate us into thinking that war had no victims or innocent losses and or damage. And I contrast that with what we learned, I guess, through Collateral Murder in that video. Yeah. But I also, I don't know a lot about Julian Assange's philosophy.
But, you know, I wanted to actually add this something because the you know, term collateral damage, right? Mm. That's actually is a euphemism used mm-hmm. to kind of soften up and then to think that, okay, you know, if we call dead people as innocent, you know, innocent civilians being killed, for instance, right? The dead body of innocent civilians, that would kind of evoke some feelings that we would feel like, oh, okay, people are dying, right? But if you call them as collateral damage, then somehow like it doesn't, it's kind of softened up. It makes us be numb, right? It conceals, the language conceals the reality. So I think that what Julian, of course, you know, released the authentic WHO material that has not been altered or anything, right? It's authenticated the real material. And because, you know, that he believes that because he released the material entirely, that he has, he can engage in some kind of editorial, you know, artistic kind of editorial spin on the title. So that's why he terms as collateral damage, collateral murder. And so that was, I mean, that's true, right? If you look at it, it's murder. We cannot ever call, you know, have you watched the collateral murder video?
If I did, it was a long time, like around 2010 or 2011, if I did.
How did you feel like? Did you feel like, you know, I mean, that did this do something to you?
I mean, the whole notion of this nation state fighting wars overseas for generations sickens me in so many ways. This wasn't so much eye-opening for me in terms of, wow, this is happening. It was, wow, someone pierced the bubble and was able to share the video. And in a lot of ways, the key was the way they edited the video, both the footage, but also how they described the video, titled the video. It's instrumental in everything. And that, to me, was the pen's mightier than the sword. But what I've been confounded by, I haven't gone down the rabbit hole so much, because I don't know if there's a truth machine here, but you know, I feel like, I don't know if Julian Assange or WikiLeaks is a publisher. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a state level actor in the sense that it's supported by another state. I don't know if it's a fourth estate level actor where it's its own state and it's taking on states. And I wonder if this is all altruistic and whether any of that matters. You know, but the fact that Julian is not anonymous or didn't go undercover.
Right.
You know,
And I think that, this low, uncensored low image of modern war, you know, that it's provided by WikiLeaks. And you know, I could say, you know, the enduring Vietnam War that, famous, this Vietnamese napalm girl, you know, the girl who was basically bombed, right? And she was running naked. And that, I think that picture alone, the one picture had changed the public sentiment at that time. Because, you know, people, you know, at this point, that people have to recognize that their government war is killing innocent children, right? So, and I think that at that time when WikiLeaks came to public limelight with that publication, many people immediately kind of, some celebrated the publication and they were like calling Julian the hero, right? But while other people at the same time were kind of skeptical, like saying, okay, what is this, this organization? You know, we never heard of this organization. And is this kind of some kind of subversive organization that tried to undermine the US military power or whatever, right? So, and that came from actually US soldiers, many of the US soldiers kind of turned against the whistleblower Chelsea Manning. What's interesting is that WikiLeaks is a transnational organization. It's basically composed of a network of people around the world, activists, journalists, and now lawyers around the world are being a part of, you know, Julian's legal team trying to help Julian free. But you see new network of new transnational network, right? And then, so this is an interesting phenomenon, I mean, in some ways that, and I always looked at the WikiLeaks as cultural phenomena and not just the, you know, WikiLeaks as a journalistic organization, not just, you know, its significance is in changing the media landscape, but the significance of WikiLeaks it actually goes much deeper. And then that's actually relates to Bitcoin as well, because Bitcoin is a global network. It's a stateless currency, you know, and WikiLeaks is also stateless journalism. So anyway, yeah. So I find definitely that these two are closely linked.
Yeah. And all this, just to preface, like, I don't think of you as speaking for WikiLeaks. I'm just asking your opinion and I love hearing all this. So I'm kind of curious, how resilient do you think WikiLeaks is today?
I came to kind of understand over the years, initially when WikiLeaks, you know, started to publish material and was able to kind of challenge the US government, US empire, and so early on, really, I mean, everybody kind of, I think, who was following the organization felt like, wow, this organization is very, very powerful. And, you know, was somehow it's very resilient to state oppression or any kind of external forces that try to shut down, right? But what I realized that it's the network. It's the network around the organization. It's a decentralized network around, built around this organization. That, you know, this WikiLeaks is not just like technology or just the one organization that does magic, you know, but it's the people around the world that they are the ones who are committed to values of social justice, values of freedom, and defending civil liberties, you know, civil rights, basic civil rights, and these the people's commitment, and of course not to forget to mention conscience of whistleblowers. So for me, that you know, that network of contagious courage, I think that's kind of how I use it, like contagious courage. I still believe in that, you know, the courage, I mean, network of contagious courage. And then if we organize and use technology, you know, whether that is Bitcoin or whether that is, you know, WikiLeaks as a kind of organization built on certain technology, you know, can actually still defend freedom. But, you know, I now realize that after Julian has been prosecuted and he is now, he still remains in prison. And of course, I mean, the US government can do anything to basically to punish anybody who challenges the US empire. So, and WikiLeaks has not been publishing. I mean, that's the fact. I mean, after Julian has been imprisoned, I mean, has been prosecuted, the WikiLeaks published two or three, I think, released two or three publications. But after that, you know, the resources and focus have been kind of given to free Julian. So, I think right now, WikiLeaks as a model, I think that there need to be some kind of a reworking. And then for me, Bitcoin actually as a technology and then the people around Bitcoin would actually carry on what Julian mm-hmm. wanted to do. And what Julian actually wanted to do was to create a world in which there is no WikiLeaks, you know, that we don't need to have organization like WikiLeaks. Mm. So if we have transparent government, right, if we have government that acts honest, we don't need WikiLeaks. We don't need whistleblowers to come forward and, you know, take risk and expose government secrecy when there is no secrecy, right? So I think that, yeah, for me, I think it's like, we have to now change the way we think about the world. And the WikiLeaks, kind of in a kind of a strange way, I think, is I think WikiLeaks is an effort to kind of fix the problems of institutional hierarchies. And the way they wanted to fix is they wanted to fight with those in power. They wanted to speak truth to power. They wanted to expose their secret. And they wanted to, you know, change the system, right? And I think that Bitcoin brings a new paradigm in which that we no longer have to fight. We no longer have to speak truth to power because, you know, there is no power in the decentralized network. And that's something that I had to learn in, you know, once I started to get into Bitcoin. This was something I personally have to learn. And I personally have to let go of all the mentalities of you know, doing activism. And yeah, so that it make sense?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's very interesting. I've been reading through your work. You even quoted Orwell and said, you know, in a time of universal deceit, speaking truth to power is a revolutionary act. Right. And I think mm-hmm. a lot of what you're talking about, you know, this melds with what WikiLeaks was doing as a network and as an idea, and what Bitcoin is doing as revolutionary money in this time of universal deceit. And I'm kind of wondering, how does money and the type of money we use affect our reality?
Yeah, I think money is kind of essential, because I think what we have now, you know, and I like the your podcast name, actually, the Bitcoin Matrix. And Bitcoiners kind of use the metaphors of the Matrix, right? The film Matrix, with Keanu Reeves being the main actor, and they always kind of have a reference to it, red pill and blue pill and the things. But I think, you know, I personally think that the film, Wachowski's siblings, the film, The Matrix, was not a science fiction. I see that as a documentary. You know, I think they, Wachowski siblings, were able to actually depict and let us see how the world works right now. And we live in this debt slavery, you know, the slavery system, and then money play an important part to enforce this system of control. And then right now, the money is being controlled by basically central banks around the world and professional economists, you know, who don't have any interest for ordinary people. You know, they have their own agendas, and they are the one who basically control. And then central banks print infinite money that you know, they just create money out of thin air. And then how the money is now used is basically to create a deception, to maintain the system of control. So I think the only way that we can actually change this matrix is to change the money, you know, to make the money be honest, make money be one that is not controlled by anyone, and which is Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is not controlled by anyone, and it is controlled by everyone at the same time. So that's the only way. And unless we fix the problem of this money being used as a tool for control, we cannot really, you know, bring about social justice, or we don't have freedom. We cannot do anything, basically. So this is one thing that I learned also, you know, after, you know, writing about WikiLeaks for the last decade, basically, is that, okay, so we, Julian had this idea, governments, you know, or conspiracy of governance, the essay that he has written in 2006, and in which he analyzed the, you know, authoritarian regime, you know, and basically the patronage network of governments and corporations. You know, it's not just the government, but also private sectors, you know, corporations being involved, and that they use deception, they use secrecy and deception and information restriction to sustain their collaborative secrecy, right? Which, you know, Julian basically defined it as conspiracy as governance. You know, so, and then the for him, the solution was to expose the secrecy, right? And what I came to understand was that, so, okay, WikiLeaks exposed secrecy. WikiLeaks let us see governments, what our governments are doing, and, you know, help us to actually penetrate into this deception. But then what's next? And to me, it's that part, you know, that, okay, of course, you know, when you reveal the secret, you when you challenge the US empire, of course, they're going to attack you. They're going to fight back, right? They're going to chase after you. They're going to shut down, you know, anybody who basically trying to challenge the US empire, right? And so we didn't have, I think, plan B, you know, okay, plan A was to release. Okay, so what's next? So I think the Bitcoin provides a concrete way that, okay, to carry on where I think WikiLeaks left off, that now we can actually create our own network of trust and live under our own rules, and that we can make their system obsolete, right? Because if we don't have an alternative, if we don't have a tool to create alternative, we cannot really exit the matrix. We still are held in this, you know, debt slavery system, and the financial incentives are set against us. So no matter how we try to defend our freedom, no matter how much, you know, we try to defend the values that we believe in, right? Our financial incentives are set against us. Then it's almost like the fish trying to swim against the current, and how hard it is, right? And no matter how much like people are dedicated, and I worked with very dedicated activists, you know, they do anything. They're you know, they're hardworking people, and but at the end of the day, you know, they cannot pay the bills. You know, they have to go to work and then be a part of military industrial complex. They have to, you know, their tax money is used to fund wars and things like that. So Bitcoin, yeah, Bitcoin for me does give us more concrete tool.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, yeah, it seems like what you're getting at is that, you know, in the current system of deceit, we're not able to really connect to our instincts.
Exactly.
And how do you think Bitcoin or adopting Bitcoin affects our connection to reality and maybe natural law?
Very good question that you have, because, you know, this is one thing I started to recognize. I mean, not just from my personal experience, but looking at the Bitcoin, you know, community or Bitcoin, you know, how people interact on Twitter, for instance, right? And then now there's this talk about Bitcoin pleb culture and how the online people are being empowered, and there's that recognition that the Bitcoiners are kind of maybe different in some ways, that they are starting to share their own experience of how Bitcoin changes them. And that, and then what I came to realize is that our system, you know, so let's call the system that we live in, this fiat system, the matrix, okay? So because it's really the matrix. So that what matrix does is it kind of disconnects us from our own instinct, right? So that make us actually trust external authorities, whether they're banks, politicians, or professors, right, doctors, you know, we are made to kind of trust them. And somehow we are told that they know more than you do, right? So you have to go to doctor to see, to have him check your body and then tell us, you know, what's wrong with our body. So then, of course, I mean, we can use expert knowledge, right? But then it got to the point where we completely trust doctors that we don't even know, you know, how we feel. Like we are the only one. You know, those of us who are connected to our body know when something is wrong with us, then what's wrong with us. We have this intuitive knowing. And then somehow I think that what happened is that this, you know, the matrix system that created hierarchical systems. And then, you know, that's actually very much prevalent in academia as well, that higher education. And then what I recognize is that people who go through higher education, like, you know, like myself, I got PhD, they are actually more disconnected from our you know, their own instinct, including myself. Like, I have to kind of come to terms with that, because we were kind of taught to we were taught that we don't know, we have no ways to validate our experience, we have no way to know truth, that we have you know, look up to authority outside, right? So the system that we have, this matrix system, disconnects us from the instinct. And what Bitcoin does is that it connects us with our own instincts, because of the fact that Bitcoin is actually a part of nature and is deeply connected. You know, I think the Bitcoin is a technology that find a way to reconnect, you know, reconnect money with its own roots, you know, which is nature, part of nature, I think. And so that's the one important thing. And what I found interesting is that the intuition, you know, that we have, we all have intuition, or whether that is like some kind of a gut feeling, like, you know, I'm sure you had an experience where, you know, when you know something is wrong, right? Like you somebody tells you a lie, and then, but you know, your mind quite cannot understand, like, okay, this person seems to be a nice person, and he seems to be trustworthy, yet I feel somewhere like, you know, I can't trust this person, right? And how many times do we actually override this innate instinct and then, you know, just go with what we think is right, right?
Yeah.
And then it turned out always trusting our own instincts to always help us, because our body, you know, like gut feeling that tells us or knows something that our mind cannot quite understand. Very much I think it's the Bitcoin restored actually our connection to instinct. And also the fear culture disconnected from the instinct. And then this is actually, I think, carefully engineered. I think it was a carefully engineered system that they know that, you know, if somehow the people who run this system know that if they were able to disconnect us from instinct, that they somehow can, you know, control us and that, yeah, they can actually maintain their power.
Right.
And I think that's why I you know, the people in Bitcoin network, that they are more kind of, I think, become aware or started to kind of a question, I think, that this mainstream narratives, you know, that come from this establishment about the solution to the pandemic, you know, that the, for instance, that this initiative foreshadowed by the Great Reset, you know, the World Economic Forum, for instance, you know, they use certain language, right? Like, you know, I don't know if you are following this, but are you kind of following what they're up to?
Yeah, but I do have questions for you about it. So I'd love to hear you, you know, about transhumanism. I think I'd love to hear you define what that is and what they're looking to do
right,
there
right.
And how that fits in. And I'm also curious, just along the lines of what we were just talking about, did, you know, as a culture, did we trade our authenticity for acceptance?
Oh, definitely. Exactly. I mean, that's just, again, going back to our disconnection to our own instinct. And then again, the doublespeak, you know, I actually have to refer to the Orwell's doublespeak. And then remember, like, Orwell's 1984, you know, in his novel, he talks about doublespeak and, you know, the voice, peace, and ignorance and strength, and right?
Yeah.
And so it's just the language that conceals our reality, the language, the use of language that deceive us, right? So it's and then again, going back to the WikiLeaks publication of the collateral matter. And it was the right. Real images, when real images are brought to us, then each person was able to actually connect to the real image, the uncensored reality, right? Instead of like the journalists or politicians, you know, or the military officers telling us what reality is, that each person can have immediate, you know, the uncensored, direct connection to experience. And that was the power that I think WikiLeaks brought. And then how this real law, you know, the real experience, authentic experience has been covered up was by the use of euphemism, such as collateral damage, right? So, and I think so that's just one thing. So, and then, you know, if you look at the global reset, you know, what they're doing, that they also use the kind of euphemism they use the language of destroying harmony with nature. And then we have to, you know, create a sustainable future, just and humane and sustainable future. And then if you just only look at the language and then just, you know, what's up on their website, you know, because their website has a whole description about what they're up to. It's not like they're hiding. And if you just look at it on the surface, it looks good. It looks like so much like a utopic, you know, that they're talking about, you know, restoring harmony with nature and, you know, having the sustainable future and combating climate change and everything sounds great, you know, equality and liberty for all the people. But again, it's the euphemism. It's the how they are using language to deceive us. And what's interesting is, I think Bitcoin actually does that. Without kind of talking about doing this PR, you know, how Bitcoin restores our society, our connection to nature and stuff like that. But Bitcoin actually does what Global Reset initiatives claim that they are going to do. You know, and you know, Bitcoin, of course, you know, is a technology created by cypherpunks, and cypherpunks' motto is cypherpunks write code. You know, they don't engage in PR, they don't tell us what to do and stuff. They just simply write code. So, you know, that's again the difference that, you know, and then what I find is what's happening is it's really the humanity now is being attacked. I think what it makes us human has been kind of attacked by, you know, certain sector of humanity, I say. And then they are the one who actually use the fake word. They use deception as a means to, you know, deceive us. And so then we just, because when we are disconnected from our reality, then we are actually not connecting to the real world. We are interacting with the artificial world. And that's how I, and when I look at it, it's that we are actually living in a very artificial world. I think in 2017 or so, when I first kind of started to become interested in, no, actually in 2016, when I became interested in this idea of transhumanism, my neighbor actually had this book titled kind of Pandemic. Actually, it was interesting, the book titled Pandemic. And then it was about transhumanism. And I, you know, before that, he gave it to me. And before that, I kind of heard about it, but then I wasn't really paying attention to it. And when I kind of read that book, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, is this now happening? And so I kind of started to really pay attention to this agenda of transhumanism. But then around that time in 2016, I remember seeing the article in which Elon Musk said something about, he believes that we are living in a simulation, right? Then I thought, wow, that's a crazy idea. Like, okay, so we are kind of inside of somehow like living in this kind of a virtual reality or simulation, and that's not real reality, or, you know, but certainly like something that made me think about, you know, what is real. And the you know, like the Matrix question, you know, Neo had this question of what is real, right? And so the fiat system basically disconnects us from real reality, you know, the real world, that uncensored world, unmediated world. And the unmediated world, you know, which I could maybe define it as natural world, you know, natural world or universe, or, you know, whatever people call it, right? And that, you know, this world has been basically kind of kept out from us. And the trusted third parties, you know, banks, financial institutions, politicians and teachers, you know, they are the gatekeepers, basically. They kind of create this patronage network to prevent us from actually entering into this uncensored real world, you know, and somehow, and then they make us kind of interact with one another in this artificially created world, like simulation, right? And then this whole world is basically it's being controlled, and then we are told that we are free, but then this is very much conditioned freedom. You know, the freedom that we have is illusion, because we are actually domesticated. We become like domesticated animals, and then we were told, you know, like the, I don't know if you know, behaviorist, the psychologist B.F. Skinner. Do you know him? If you study psychology a little bit, then everybody have to learn B.F. Skinner.
Oh, yeah.
You know, B.F. Skinner, you know, which, I mean, I really hated him when I was studying. Like, we joked around that instead of calling him B.F. Skinner, it's a B.S. Skinner, you know, he's such a B.S. But, you know, he had this idea that, you know, human behaviors can be understood experimenting on rats and pigeons. And what he came up with is this famous invention, is Skinner's box. And then he, you know, put the rat in a box, in a maze, you know, and then he creates electric shock and then see how rats respond. And then, then that learns over time, that if you go to, you know, certain direction, then you get you get electrified. So then they would avoid, you know, pain. So they would change their behavior, right? So that was he kind of trying to look at how rats behave to kind of understand human behavior. And then this, to understand human behavior is one thing, but I think what he went wrong, tremendously wrong, is to try to apply that knowledge to control human behavior. So that's, I think, a wrong, you know, ethically wrong use of psychological knowledge, in my opinion. So this, you know, as I see it, it's this matrix that we live in is kind of like the Skinner's box. And then it's not just that the people who control this are not just the bankers or politicians, you know, the psychologists are involved in this, that, you know, the psychological knowledge is used to control humans, used to domesticate humans. And then the you know, like you pointed out, the first thing is to basically compromise our instinct. And, you know, if you look at natural world, if you look at animals, you know, all animals, they know when they're in danger, and then they know what to do, because they follow their instinct, right? And humans are only ones that kind of, I think, you know, our mind kind of can override our instinct and then make us not to kind of follow instinct. So this matrix system is created in a way that make us, yeah, you know, kind of make us act against our instinct and act against our self-interest, basically. Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. And the transhumanism, this is the idea, basically, that trying to reinvent humans, you know, I think from my perspective, as I understand it, it's almost like they wanted to reinvent humans in the image of a machine. So they want us to kind of become like robot, or, you know, for us to migrate into the cyberspace, and we kind of forever lives on the internet, and that we disconnect ourselves from our body and social connections, you know, and we become kind of part of, yeah, basically like rats, you know, in Skinner's box. And they, what they do is that, I think the defining feature of transhumanism is they believe that the humans, that, you know, so-called transhumanists, you know, who work with this idea, that they believe that humans can evolve, human can be advanced more than what we are now. So we could kind of become superhuman. I mean, in from their perspective, superhuman meaning like transcending the old kind of human attributes. And they consider disease, death, you know, and certain emotions like sadness, you know, or to be kind of negative, something negative that we need, can eradicate, you know, we humans, superhumans, or you know, trans, once you elevate yourself to the transhuman state, then we don't experience sadness, we don't experience disease, we could be, you know, forever happy. So that's kind of, and they are trying to use technology to create this kind of new species, so to speak, you know. And then I think what's important to me is, you know, for me, what I found troubling is that how this transhumanism agenda has been carried on without people really knowing about it. I don't think that the, you know, people who are politically engaged, you know, and informed, that they don't, many of them don't actually know what that is. And then actually there is this plan. And the World Economic Forum's chairperson, Klaus Schwab, he's a well-known transhumanist. And, you know, as I researched more into their initiatives, that it's become clear that their agenda is really that they want to create the post-human future, you know, the future that doesn't, you know, in which we have no humanity, basically. So I think that what's important is, I think we need to start having conversation about what makes us human, you know? What are the important attributes that makes us human? Do we want to become kind of being that doesn't feel, you know, that only experience certain emotions and not be able to experience the fullness of emotions? I mean, if we take away what we consider to be, you know, mistakes or, you know, errors or sadness or, yeah, unhappiness or what does that mean to us, right? I don't, you know, some people might say, oh yeah, I want to have kind of, I want to live in the kind of state that I could be only happy. And, but that's like, you know, you become like a robot, right? If you don't experience, range of emotions and if you're kind of almost like reprogrammed into kind of, you know, to feel in a certain way, think in a certain way, then you become automaton. So, yeah, that's something that I'm very concerned, and I think that, you know, the people around the Bitcoin actually could, you know, the network built around the Bitcoin could actually start asking this question, you know, and then more actively engaged in this process of, you know, where about where our society is going.
Yeah. I have so many questions here. One, you mentioned Aaron McCollum's 2013 book, The Pandemic, and in it he describes transhumanists' aim to synthetically involve the human race more rapidly than organic evolution allows, right, and to create post-human civilization, also referred to as human 2.0. So my first question there is this even possible, do you think? Or is this just Frankenstein stuff?
No, I think it's possible. It is possible. And as I said, and it happens in a very discreet, in a way that we don't recognize, I think many of us don't recognize. And then again, going back to this, how we are cut off from our instinct, right? And that I think there are actually, I'm gonna get into a little bit the esoteric domain here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So I studied, of course, Carl Jung, and Carl Jung kind of get into this, it goes deeper than what Freud discovered. Freud discovered the unconscious, and Jung actually went deeper than that. And the one thing that he came up with is that he found the phenomena he terms synchronicity. And I don't know if you are familiar with that, synchronicity. But that synchronicity is basically is a way to kind of describe the related incident that cannot be explained through causality, right? It's kind of like a meaningful coincidence. That's kind of like how we understand it. But it's not in a linear sense of like cause and effect, because I did this, and that's why this caused, I created this action A, and then action A created action B. So it's not like that. It's a causal link, a causal relationship, and the things that happen simultaneously. So his concept of synchronicity really challenged the conventional view of physics, and the Einstein's view of kind of relativity, for instance, and more the Jung's idea is more kind of tapping into this, the discovery of quantum physics actually. And what I found interesting is there are forces that cannot be explained and are rejected by modern science, okay? And these are, things like synchronicity, magic, miracle, the things that we cannot quite explain, right? And in our world, this matrix system that we live in, it's based on this kind of a mechanical universe. Like the universe is like, works like a machine. It's like we live in this mechanical machine and then linear timeline. And then, so if you create this stimulus, then it triggers a certain response. And then what they want to do, people who believe in this mechanistic view of the universe. I mean, which I think to some degree it's true. I think it's depending on where in your, what level of consciousness that you exist in, that you I think that we changes the understanding of the universe. So the old theories that are out there, Einstein's relativity or quantum physics, they all are valid, I think, all are true, pointing to some kind of true reality, truths about how we experience the world. But it's also the different kind of principles work depending on the level of our consciousness, and in that, the matrix system basically eliminates anything that cannot be explained by modern science, and then it created, in my opinion, it's created artificial, the artificial experience, artificial reality, and that we get to the point where we don't even know. Like I think many people who live in the cities, that they don't even know they live on the earth. They are so disconnected from natural world that, and they are walking through this large buildings that they somehow think that they live in the city. They are cut off from this the real natural environment, right? And then, so what they are trying to do, I think the transhumanists, trying to do is they wanted to cut us off forever from these forces that cannot be explained by this mechanical universe, basically. And then they want to, so then they can control us completely. And then once our consciousness is you know, what's taken over, yeah, we actually start to exist in a different universe in some ways. And I think that it's kind of, I believe that actually we now kind of have two different networks. The humanity is now forking off, you know, they are like spreading off into two, at least two, you know, two networks. And then one is of course represented by the Common Trust Network, you know, the Global Reset initiatives that they are working to create this Common Trust Network. And then they are gonna have, you know, vaccine certificate, digital vaccine certificate. And then they're gonna use this central bank's digital currency. And then what they wanna do is that they wanna keep track of everybody's behaviors, transaction and everything. And then they are gonna use the technology, you know, biometrics, biosensor technology to kind of really, yeah, connect our bodies and connect us to their network, right? And then they are actually saying, calling that as the common network. And on the other hand, that we have Bitcoin network, you know, and that is, I think it represents something different. And I think from my perspective, Bitcoin's network is facilitating or human-led organic evolution. And then for that, what that means is basically we would have a connection to, direct connection to the universe, direct connection to natural world. And we would have uncensored, you know, peer-to-peer relationship. And, you know, so that kind of, I think that we have this contrasted two networks. This contrasting network is something that I became kind of aware of and become, you know, felt that it's very important for me to articulate how they are different. You know, recognition of these two networks, contrasting networks, didn't come just with Bitcoin, you know, me studying about Bitcoin, but it came earlier when I was researching about WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks is what is around WikiLeaks, you know, is a decentralized network of ordinary people, you know, activists, journalists, hackers, and, you know, cryptographers and lawyers, you know, people around the world that they are actually working together. And for the value of freedom of speech that they believe in. And that what's interesting is, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Edward Snowden, that when Edward Snowden released the NSA documents and he, you know, went to Hong Kong, right, to escape. And then WikiLeaks investigative journalist at that time, Sarah Harrison, that she, you know, she was sent to kind of rescue Edward Snowden. So she went to Hong Kong to, you know, help Ed move to, you know, move out of Hong Kong. And then they actually ended up in Russia unintentionally, you know, that Russia was supposed to be the transit and then they wanted to go to actually South America, but, you know, United States canceled Edward Snowden's passport, so they couldn't do. They got stuck in Moscow. But what happened was, what's interesting is, there is a story that I find that magnificent. Was that okay? So Edward Snowden was in Hong Kong, and the U.S. government already kind of trying to hunt him down, and they charged Edward Snowden under Espionage Act. And at that time, there was this short window of time that Edward Snowden was ever be able to escape from this, you know, overreaching hand of the United States of government. And the U.S. government at a crucial moment, they made a mistake. They they misspelled Edward Snowden's middle name. And that gave them some time for them to escape. Right. So there was some kind of the force. I think I recognize that there is a force to help them out of there, you know, and then some person might, people might say, oh, that's just a coincidence, but, or that's just accident, or, you know, they would maybe dismiss. But for me, it's no, this help or this some kind of something that happened that helped them, you know, that gave them some time. This was significant. This was something like the force that modern science cannot explain, you know, maybe miracle, grace, you know, all of those things, right? So that force is always working through us, right? But we are disconnected from it because we were taught not to believe in it. we are taught, first of all, to think that there is no such forces. And we have to actually somehow exist within this small box of Skinner, you know, Skinner box. And then that's, you know, what you see outside is all you can see, and you can depend, you have to depend on the government. You know, you cannot grow your own food. You have to buy it, buy them at the grocery store. You have to go to see a doctor. You know, everything is just within this small box. And then we are, you know, disconnected from whole infinite possibilities that exist out there. And that, you know, that we can actually connect with one another and then find solutions that are not offered by the system, right? So, if that makes sense.
That made a lot of sense and just raised so many questions for me, especially along the lines of, you know, this common trust network, which I'll acknowledge and stipulate, and the Skinner, you know, the BS Skinner, rats in the box, right?
Right, right.
And the Matrix. And what it makes me think of is, you know, I was consumed with trying to find the truth and the signals and the real reality externalities outside the box, and trying to understand what's going on with Assange and Snowden and Ross and all these issues, Russia, China, their involvement in those individual issues and those broader networks and issues. And then I think about how, yeah, I think they have control over the Matrix. And,
right, exactly.
And my assumption there is when I hear about like new technology, like say deep fakes, right? My assumption there is that the military has probably been working on this for 20 years before we hear about it, and that they've probably perfected it for 5 years before they even tease it in the news, so that they can kind of pre-message things and sort of control the box, control the Matrix. And so my issue is whenever I go try to figure out what's going on with Assange or Snowden and why, how did he end up in Russia and what did we learn about this? And I wonder, is this truly a signal, like you were saying, and yeah, you have to go to your gut, but is this a signal of truth, or is this the Matrix trying to manipulate me and soften me to them spying on me? And maybe they want me to know about this, or they want, and it's even could be even little details within a broader thing. So maybe Snowden's one thing, but maybe his enemies release a detail that's true or not that I might hear, that might skew my thinking. And so with Bitcoin, I really just was able to release all of that and almost give up on that mystery and intrigue, because there was so much intrigue to it because it was just fascinating. And, right. And you want to find revolution and you want to find justice, you want to find truth. And it became so difficult. And Bitcoin almost just set me free from all of that.
Right.
So exactly. I can almost be a little bit more of a spectator and not think my life depended on finding truth there.
Right. And I think that the one thing that I also recognized after, you know, being deeply involved in the effort to, you know, free Julian and, you know, help his legal situation for the, you know, over the decade, basically, was that, you know, my experience has been kind of very oppressive and disempowering, you know, very disempowering experience because of the fact that, you know, here we are taught to kind of believe in democracy, right? That there is this, the systems of checks and the balance of power. And then many activists were made to believe that, yeah, you know, there is this system of accountability, and then all we have to do is that we have to demand politicians. We have to have these human rights campaigns and make politicians to act, you know, for our interests. And then we did that. I think I did that, you know, for a long time. I believed in this, especially this U.S. Constitution has this, you know, great mechanism of system of checks and the balance of power. But then I realized, oh, okay, when the system itself has been taken over by those in power, you know, the judicial branch and the executive branch, everything is just taken over by them. So then there is no, you know, justice system, right? The judges are paid, they are bought by those in power, and then they don't have any judicial, you know, real judicial autonomy to actually, you know, to really judge whether the situation is just or not. Of course, the money is already corrupted, so that they have, those in power have infinite amount of resources to corrupt more, you know, the legal systems or media or whatever, right? So then, you know, I couldn't just go with this idea of, oh, you know, he worked hard, you know, he just try everything you can to bring accountability and really speak to these politicians and engage in this campaign. I didn't think that was really realistic. And I, you know, I mean, believe me, I have done a lot of work. And then what I realized after being so deeply engaged in this effort was that, you know what, in this system, we don't have power. We are basically living this, you know, pretense of democracy, and that democracy become like a, you know, it's a charade, and it's a system of control, part of the system of control, you know, including electoral politics, basically. And then we were given kind of an illusion of freedom. So that's why we kind of start to getting involved but in this, in this, we were spectator, you know, and we are being made to be a spectator, and not only being spectators, somewhat, you know, if you are not careful, you become useful idiots, basically, that those in power can use you as a way to kind of create civil war, create a division among us, among ordinary people, and then, you know, all the kind of things that, you know, the film Matrix, as we saw, how the agent Smith multiplies, and then, you know, and there was this explanation that if you are not unplugged from the system, you are part of them, right? So basically, nobody is not neutral in the system. If you are not awake like Neo, then you are part of the Matrix. You are helping agent Smith, you know? So, I mean, so then I realized that, okay, so in this, that ordinary people don't have the power to write their own script. We are made to just carry on the narratives that are imposed upon us. And in those narratives, even the most empowering narratives that we can get within that storyline that they create is activists who are fighting, you know, the heroes, you know, who are fighting against this. So that's all we can have. But then the destiny of the character, destiny of Hilo is always, is to be, met with assassination or being imprisoned. And it's never be a happy ending because of the fact it's those who control the history, basically, those who control money, they are the one who write the story and give us narratives, right? So then here is the thing that Bitcoin enlightened me, actually, is that Bitcoin allow us to actually not be a spectator. And then here it's again connected to the discovery of quantum physics, for instance. And in the quantum physics, there is this idea that there is this effect that the observers actually can change the reality. So it's not like the objective reality is out there that is completely absolute and fixed, right? There isn't like this objective reality that, okay, this is the objective one that, you know, that stands outside of me, separated from me. No, the quantum physics tells us it's how you perceive your consciousness actually play a part in, you know, creating a reality that you observe. So then the way to actually change, you know, society or way to change your situation that you're in is not trying to change what is outside, but to try to change our consciousness. So that is a huge, I think, for me, paradigm shift, give me a huge paradigm shift. And then Bitcoin really facilitated for me to understand this, is that Bitcoin, you know, you know, people say often like Bitcoin doesn't care who you are, you know, Bitcoin doesn't really, yeah. And I think it's true that Bitcoin give us kind of power to, or reminded us of the power, our own power of a kind of consciousness, our power as creator, you know, that we are the one who actually create. We have ability to create narratives, right? And then become the kind of person that we wish to, you know, see in the world, and then interact with one another and create a kind of new world, I think. And so it doesn't matter. Like one hand, like, you know, I have this, I looked up news and the news tells me one thing. And then like you're saying about maybe the Snowden disclosure, you know, I have heard that from other people as well that okay, maybe Snowden wanted us to know about this spying because then we would be fearful that self-censoring and things like that, right? And so that was kind of a maybe intentional release or leak, you know? And you know, we can all speculate, you know, what is right and what is wrong with limited information perhaps. And we might never be able to understand what is true, right? But for me, the Bitcoin actually kind of taught me that it really doesn't matter what's happening outside. I mean, we can use it as a reference point that, okay, this is kind of what's happening outside, but we don't allow what is happening outside to dictate our own reality. Mm-hmm. And that recognizing that we are the one, our consciousness actually has the power to shape the world, shape the reality that we want to see. And that, you know, it really doesn't matter whatever it is happening. What matters is, you know, that's each moment, I think that we can actually focus on, being existing as one that we would like to. And I think for me, as someone who, you know, is deeply into Bitcoin, Bitcoin network, it is this idea of individual sovereignty, and that's been important to me. And for, so that I, you know, when I now come across news, then I would, you know, before I kind of deeply engage with it and allow that piece of information to define my reality, I would actually disengage myself from that and then say, okay, this is one perspective being projected out there. And, you know, and then what I want, you know, I would ask myself, what kind of world that I want to be a part of, right? Do I want to be a part of a world in which that there is this injustice or wars, and you have to kind of somehow stop it? Or do you want to kind of contribute into creating a world that is peaceful and humane? So each time I think that, for me, I mean, this is something that changed me profoundly, that I now live, I try to live without any stories, mm-hmm. identities, and that, you know, to keep that kind of a space for choice that I would choose, like each moment that I would choose, kind of reality that we want to be a part of. I know it's kind of a little esoteric, but the important thing is that Bitcoin created that, brought a huge paradigm shift that, you know, the world, you know, what we have, that this matrix system is the world constructed through the creed of objectivity, constructed through the you know, scientific creed of objectivity, which is actually not true objectivity at all. You know, it's filled with subjective agendas and things, but they call it as objective, you know? And so that world, you know, out there that is, you know, that make us believe that that's objective real world, and you know, which is not the case. And then Bitcoin kind of allow us to restore our connection to subjectivity and say, you know, if we don't like what we see outside, then we have a choice to opt out. We don't have to be a part of it. And then it is true. It is, I think, true in a concrete sense as well, because people who now enter into Bitcoin network, they can actually opt out from, you know, being a part of fiat system if they want to, right? Of course, it takes a lot of effort now, but you know, that you can actually live right now without ever being a part of, you know, maybe fiat system if you want to, right?
Yeah.
Then, you know, Bitcoin created choice, basically. You know, do you want to be a part of this system? The system that tells us what is reality for us, you know, instead of us deciding what is reality and then using our creative power to participate in defining what is real, you know, being a part of, defining what is real and become an author of our own stories. You know, that's the Bitcoin paradigm. And the fiat paradigm is basically the one that you're part of, you know, you're part of the characters of our story, you know, our as like those global leaders, that they are the authors, and that they write their own stories, and then they impose roles on us, and then you know, we simply accept the reality that is handed down to us, and then that whole mechanism of verification of the reality is, you know, through their institution, you know, institution of modern journalism and central banks and everything, and then they say, oh, you know, this is objective news, this is objective money, you know, and when it's not, you know.
Yeah. I have a, you know, it's interesting. I really feel that listening to what we've been talking about, that like it further reinforces that for me. I think Bitcoin is this battle of freedom that's personal and individual, and that humans have forked. And in a weird way, there's always going to be this exchange rate between Bitcoiners and non-Bitcoiners in terms of reality and their experience of reality. And I'm kind of looking forward to this tipping point where we're all back on the same chain or the same time chain. And I don't know if we ever get there. And one of my questions for you is, you know, especially from your, with your perspective, your background, your experience, your education, do you think there's more suffering in the world today than, you know, 100 or 1,000 years ago? Or is it just, you know, there's more people and therefore we have more people suffering, but from a pro rata standpoint, suffering has always been part of human existence and there's always been control mechanisms? Or is it getting worse for humanity?
I don't know, but I think it's kind of worse for humanity now. And I kind of studied the indigenous cultures because I was drawn to understanding Native Americans, for instance, and especially I have kind of connection to Hopi tribes. And, you know, what I found interesting was that they had such a autonomous society that they didn't, you know, have kind of institutions like, you know, they had their own governance, but it's decentralized and it's not like the institutionalized, and they didn't have these doctors and they had medicine men, you know, who kind of had a different way of approaching health, you know, I guess. But then what's interesting is that they follow their instinct, and then their society isn't complex, you know, and then it's don't think that there was so much suffering, you know, that, you know, the one hand, like one would, oh, you know, these people who didn't have any technologies and how could they live, you know, how they were overcoming disease and all of that stuff, you know, but, you know, from a modern person's perspective, but interestingly that they were actually doing well. And in fact, that I heard the story that some white people actually decided to live with Native Americans, and, you know, they went into their, be a part of their culture and then live there. And then they were asked to come back, and then all of them didn't want to come back, right? They said, I'm fine being here. I'm happy. Like all of a sudden, like all depression and my illness and everything is gone and I'm happy now, right? And then, on the other hand, the Native Americans, they were asked to live with white people and, you know, be a part of this white culture. And then all of them, they said, I want to go back, you know? So, I mean, that's a kind of interesting thing. And I think, now we have media, so we kind of more understand what's happening around the world. So it's, you know, I think the human suffering could be amplified. I mean, it's again, if you look at the media, you know, I mean, what kind of consciousness or energies that you get, you know, do you ever like feel happy after watching news, evening news, for instance, you know, that they don't really talk about what's happening, you know, the happy things or good things happening in the world, that they're like to focus on, you know, kind of problems and things like that, or make us feel fearful, right? And at the end of, you know, maybe watching TV, watching evening news, you know, we feel kind of somehow like, oh gosh, you know, there's so much suffering, and then I feel like doomed, you know, as a species that I cannot do anything, and then wow, I have to be fearful about what's happening. So that's, I think, the effect of this mainstream media. And you know, of course, you know, again, who is controlling mainstream media and what agendas, you know, what for they use this, you know, the media as a format, of course, it is to control human consciousness, you know, so that we will have always like a fear, like we would only experience a certain range of emotions like fear, anxiety and depression and things like that. And Bitcoiners, you know, the one thing that I found interesting about Bitcoiners is that, you know, of course, they have certain characteristics that I find interesting. One of it is relentless optimism. They are very optimistic. They are hopeful, you know, and that they have that they even exhibit that certain emit certain energies. And, you know, when I go through this Twitter's timeline of my, you know, friends, the progressive friends, and they are more focused on political problems, you know, oh God, US invaded Syria, oh my God, you know, again, there's this bomb being dropped, and right, so it's negative incidents that are kind of streaming toward me. And then when I switch back to Bitcoiners timeline, and then of course, you know, it's somehow like it's more hopeful, like relentless optimism, and then, you know,
on that note, do you think everyone has genius level talent?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I would not say that, I would not say as genius as, again, it's, you know, I think, again, our culture, this matrix control system, basically it's based on, you know, starting point is that we are nobody. You know, that's the metric system tells us you are nobody. So that's why, because you are nobody, because you are a blank slate, so you have to acquire things. You have to go to good university and get a good degree to be respected. You have to have a, you know, like a handsome guy or whatever to become like, you know, attractive or whatever, you know, all of those kind of signals that they send us, right? For us to improve and then for us to become something. And of course, part of this control mechanism is the creation of celebrity culture. And then what they do is that they put forward a certain kind of celebrities and then, you know, highlight the what they are good at, whether they are musicians or painters or whatever, you know. And then those manufactured celebrities, they are elevated, you know, artificially, in my opinion, though, is that, you know, because they are, you know, they were kind of produced, you know, that's maybe a good word, to kind of speak to masses, you know, to masses' desires, and then these people are going to follow after them and they worship celebrities. And so within that, you know, there's this, I think that the genius is defined as you have to become exceptional. You have to, you know, if you're going to play the guitar, you have to become like, you know, Jimi Hendrix. Otherwise, you are not going to make it, or you're not genius, right? Or like you know, you have to sing a song like John Lennon, or, you know, like something like that, you know. But I think for me, genius, it's, you know, the epistemological word for genius is basically it's you are connected with the spirit that you are born with, and if we believe that we all have unique individuality, that everyone has unique individuality, and then everyone, I think I personally believe that everyone has something called a destiny, you know, soul destiny, some kind of a purpose in life, you know, and once we connect ourselves with it, then we are like the, you know, we are connected with our blueprint, so to speak. And then when we manifest, you know, we all are genius, and everyone is different, you know, everyone is just simply different. And then once I think we connect ourselves with that, you know, soul destiny or spirit or, you know, or unique individuality, I think that we find peace. And when I look back my life, like, you know, as example, like I cannot quite understand like how my life has been unfolded, but then there is certain scenes, you know, I meet certain people at a certain time, you know, crucial time, and then something, you know, like WikiLeaks come into my life, you know, at a certain critical time, and, you know, all of those things. And then I could like look at it and say, I would not be able to have planned it right, you know, but then there is something consistent, you know, like a thread that lands, and that I could only say it's a destiny, that somehow like I become a part of this, and then I'm, you know, supposed to do this and that. And once we align ourselves with it, then I have no kind of desire to want to become someone else. Like, I don't compare myself with other people. You know, other people might have more money, or other people might be more famous, or, you know, have a, you know, great skills than I do, or whatever. But I'm content with my own life. You know, I'm content with my own, you know, destiny. And then, so I think that's the culture I think we are moving toward, I think, with Bitcoin, you know, that is decentralized, and that allows everyone to blossom, you know, blossom into their own personhood.
Right. Yeah, can you describe maybe how Bitcoin aligns incentives around self-interest?
You know, this is another interesting thing that I found, is that when I started to, you know, again, get into the matrix of the control system, you know, this fiat system, is that, you know, the fiat system basically, you know, I'm only talking about fiat system because always it's a helpful to kind of compare, you know, Bitcoin with the fiat system to understand, you know, the how Bitcoin works. So in the fiat system, for instance, the self-interest are concentrated in a few hands. So it's you know, we live, I mean, the matrix system is hierarchically organized. So those who are on the top, right, that they actually can act out of their self-interest. And then as a matter of fact, that's all they do. They are always acting out of self-interest. And then while they are connected and acting out of their own self-interest, they tell less of us, you know, ordinary people, that it's not good for us to act out of self-interest. Right. So then, and then the way they do this, and I don't know if they actually coordinate this or it's just happened to be, you know, the sectors with different interests, self-interest coming in to do this. I'm not sure. But what's interesting is that religion is used as a primal tool to actually send us a message to control our behavior. And then, you know, what's interesting is that, OK, I wasn't grown up with Christianity at all. But I have some Christian friends. So I asked my Christian friends, so, you know, you grew up as Catholic, for instance, you know, and in Bible, did Jesus ever say the importance of self-interest? Did Jesus say, like, you know, it's good for us to love ourselves? Did he ever say that, right? And then all of my friends actually, you know, who are very kind of, yeah, deeply into Christianity, they say, no. The only thing that, you know, Jesus said was, no, love the other as you love yourself, right? So that's, you know, that's the only kind of maybe a process that Jesus said, you know, that kind of pointing to the self-love. But then again, it's the emphasis was given to self, I mean, loving other person. So what I found interesting is, okay, in Bible or the Christianity or the structure of religion, at least the one that is very much propagated, promoted, I think, and maybe there are different interpretations that I don't know, but the ones that is mainly promoted is this idea of, okay, you have to love your father, you know, you have to love your God, right? So then love your God and love your neighbor. But in that, okay, where is love yourself? Because if you don't love yourself first, how can you love God? How can you love the another person, right? It's kind of like the, you know, when you know, you have to first love yourself in order to be able to actually share, you know, your love with another person. So what I found interesting is, so this matrix system, basically the, you know, it's kind of created a system where those who run this system, they are selfish. And they are actually, you know, acting out of their self-interest. Mm-hmm. But they camouflage the fact, you know, they always use doublespeak so that the people don't really know how selfish they are, right? So then they could act as, oh, you know, I am a politician who really care about my constituent, or I am, you know, humanitarian, you know, person that I want to bomb other country for humanitarian, you know, aid or whatever, right? We don't really know. Many people really don't know what they actually do. And then there is constantly, the ordinary people are constantly bombarded with the message of, you have to be nice to other person. You have to sacrifice another person, you know? You have to help other person. You have to help the poor. You have to, you know, And where is that self-love? And somehow I think that this we have created a system that we are, you know, actively act against our self-interest to the point that we can't, you know, like if we were to act out of our self-interest, somehow our culture tells us you are selfish. Like, you know, how can you act, you know, selfishly? But wait a second, you know, I'm not acting selfishly. And you, I mean, selfishly in the sense that you say, I am acting out of my self-interest, which is very important. That's the foundation, you know, that's the biological foundation for all species, you know, all the creatures. I mean, in the natural world, they of course, you know, try to preserve their life, you know, and only humans that could go against our interest, I mean, our self, I mean, the our instinct, right? Again, so what Bitcoin does for me is that if you look at the incentive, of course, and Satoshi's, I think, great, contribution was to somehow, you know, brought the self-interest back to the network so that, you know, tell everyone, it's okay, you know, it's okay for you to act out of self-interest, you know, and then actually, you know, the Nick Szabo's essay, you know, the sharing out the origin of money, in that, I think that was a really, I think that his essay, I personally think it's as important as Bitcoin white paper. And in that essay, you know, he kind of traced back the, studied the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins' idea, you know, that, which he terms the selfish genes. But his book, Richard Dawkins' book, Selfish Genes, is actually, contrary to the title, The Selfish Gene, it's all about altruism and how, you know, that we need, you know, the gene, at the gene level, that genes are programmed to preserve their lives, you know, but out of which that we can actually build the altruistic, you know, we can create altruistic human beings. So I think, yeah, so one thing that Satoshi did was really to recognize, yeah, self-interest is important. And somehow by using the method of decentralization, he found a way to distribute the right to act out of self-interest so that it's no longer be concentrated on the top, you see? Right. And that, you know, the concentration of self-interest on the top in this fiat system is actually very much, it's the problem that we face. And you know, and that's why I think that the activists and socialistic, socialists, you know, they try to challenge that self-interest, right? Who became aware of that, that they're trying to challenge. But that's just the one part of, they're not seeing the whole thing, in my opinion, because we have to first claim our right to act out of self-interest.
Yeah. Speaking of claiming our right, you know, are corporations the new kings with their own fiefdoms? And will Bitcoin defeat or win this battle for the internet and freedom? Or is it sort of an individual battle and these things might coexist for a really long time?
It's a good question. And, you know, as I said, I see Bitcoin as a part of cyberpunk's battle for freedom of internet. But, you know, I use the term battle, but I think that, you know, the best way to describe this is Bitcoin is actually the battle that we already have won. All we have to do to some degree is that we can kind of sit back and relax, you know, to some degree, you know, not you know, completely, but I think that it's Bitcoin, basically what Bitcoin does is Bitcoin preserves choice, you know, basically. So because what's happening is right now, as I said, the humanity is forking off, you know, they are kind of, you know, we are kind of going into the two networks, and that the one, you know, represented by the global reset forks, I think that they, what they do is that they wanted to coerce, you know, they use deception, you know, using doublespeak and then using economic forces as a mean to coerce people so that the people are, you know, they are willing to participate because they are deceived and they are not informed. And then of course this message of you are doing it for other people, you know, you cannot be selfish and you have to be a part of, you know, combating climate change, or you have to be selfless, you know, to help other people. And so, you know, if you buy into that narrative, then, you know, you be kind of sucked into that system thinking that you are actually doing something righteous, in my opinion, right? So that's like the way maybe the some people might be sucked into this network that is facilitated by the global reset initiatives. But the another thing is the economic coercion, as I said, so that there will be economic pressures that people don't even have a choice, let's say. You know, if you don't accept to be a part of this network, and if I don't accept the central bank's digital currency, then I lose my job. You know, I lose my livelihood. So I, even though it's against my will, I have to be a part of it, right? So that could be the second one. And what Bitcoin offers is Bitcoin basically offers a choice, saying, you know, no, there is a choice that if you really wanna be, if you don't wanna be a part of their system, then there is an alternative. And then this is, you know, the way you can do it. So I think the battle is, I think it's a different kind of battle. And you know, and this actually the battle has been the one of the major themes in my life since I was young. And I read when I was, I think at the fifth grade, I read C.S. Lewis' book, Chronicle of Narnia. Are you familiar with the book?
I did the press junket for the movie, but no, I didn't read the book or see the movie.
Yeah, so Chronicle of Narnia is basically, it's the, you know, the Aslan, the lion, you know, the lion, there's a mythical world, mythical land called Narnia, right? And then the four children, they went into this mythical land called Narnia through the wardrobe. And then the Narnia, this land had been taken over by White Witch. And then so they have always winter without Christmas. And it's interesting that, you know, so what happened is that they're going to engage in this battle. They're trying to kind of free the land of Narnia from witch, right? This evil witch. Mm-hmm. And then so the C.S. Lewis has the seven chronicles. I think the first one I read was the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think. And then the last one ended with the title, Last Battle, which I find interesting because I read, as a child, I read all of them, all six actually, except the last one. So for some reason, I didn't get to read the last one, so that is titled as The Last Battle. So, and then in 2017, I had a time to read the last one. So I, you know, finally read. And then before I read the last one and knowing the title, I always thought that, okay, this story of Chronicle of Narnia, the battle between people, you know, that I kind of as a child felt like I will become a part of this battle, you know, this moral battle. And somehow when I found WikiLeaks, I found the battle, like, this is it. This is the battle, you know, this is what I saw in the Chronicle of Narnia, you know, I'm part of freeing the effort to free Narnia, land of Narnia. But so in 2017, for some reason, I didn't read the last one. So I always thought that the last battle, you know, that this idea of last battle kind of hovers in my mind. And then in 2017, when I read it, I was stunned because I was expecting this huge battle. But then what I found was it was just a lion, you know, the Aslan, named Aslan. Instead of battle, you know, fighting against the witch, what happened was the Aslan brought the door, you know, this huge door, and let all of his creatures just go through the door. And then the old world of Narnia, you know, the Narnia that has been controlled by this evil witch, you know, it just dissipated. It's just dissolved. And then the world is reborn, and then there is new Narnia. And I was stunned because I thought that it's going to be a big battle between the two, and then there will be a bloodshed, and the people die, and stuff like that, animal dies. But in fact, on the contrary, one's just a door, you know, and a door to exit. That's it. Just go through it, just exit, simple thing, just open the door, just get through it. And then I saw that, okay, Bitcoin is that, you know? Of course, that, you know, when you go through the door, you have to go through the purification, like, you know, not everyone can go through it. And that's, again, like going back to the Matrix metaphor of, you know, when Morpheus showed Neo, you know, this famous red or blue pill, you know? And he said that I can only show you the door, but you have to walk through it, right? So I think that I'm often kind of tempted to see it as a battle and kind of expectified and stuff. But I think ultimately it's you know, Bitcoin is a battle that we already have won. And all, you know, what we need to do is just choose. That's it. Yeah. And for me, I just wanted to articulate clearly these two choices so that people are informed about these choices and that they are not going to be, you know, yeah, deceived into becoming a part of the system that they don't want to be a part of.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Just walk through the door. There'll be no bloodshed except for buying blood on the streets during
exactly.
The dips.
Right.
But I do want to read, you cited a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. Regarding the pathology of the corporate state. And I'll read this right before my last question for you. Martin Luther King Jr. saw the injustice and oppression of society, and all his life he fought against it. He pointed out how our society itself has become ill And he said he is proud to be maladjusted to the injustice of society happening in his time. Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in modern psychology. It is the word maladjusted. This word is the ringing cry to modern child psychology. Certainly, we all want to avoid the maladjusted life. In order to have real adjustment within our personalities, we all want the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurosis, schizophrenic personalities. But I say to you, my friends, as I move to my conclusion, there are certain things in our nation and in the world which I am proud to be maladjusted, and which I hope all men of goodwill will be maladjusted until the good societies realize. I say very honestly that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to become adjusted to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism, to self-defeating effects of physical violence. So my last question to you is, as a liberation psychologist, can you liberate yourself from Bitcoin?
Oh, that's an interesting question. But first of all, thank you for reading this beautiful quote from Martin Luther King. I think this quote really sums up, I think, the situation that we live in and how we actually are, like, you know, moral justice to the culture that is pathological, you know? So it is very insightful. Thank you for, you know, bring this up and share here. But yeah, I think that, can you liberate from Bitcoin? I mean, that's I think that I've been thinking about this for a long time. And I'm reminded of the fact, actually, that Bitcoin is a technology, and technology remains to be a tool. You know, it's never be something that we give our power to. So what is most important, I think, you know, what is really significant is who we are, us as humans. And the Bitcoin, you know, as Paul Tudor Jones, the, you know, the hedge fund manager, really on there, you know, betting on Bitcoin is betting on human ingenuity. And I think he really tapped into this, the spirit of Bitcoin, really, but I think Bitcoin is, as I see it, Bitcoin is a tool that help humanity, help us liberate ourselves from this matrix system. But it's us who does it, who do it, you know, it's not the technology itself. So that there is this, I think that some, I think cyberpunks, this idea of, you know, just simply deploy the technology out there and then, you know, then that would disrupt and then we would have civil liberties or something like that. Or like some, you know, cyberpunks actually, they kind of like, sometimes I wonder if they want to live in the cyberspace and just leave the bodies, you know? So that we somehow like escape into this cyberspace and leaving this off world of, you know, natural world or, you know, the real world, so to speak. But I think that, again, the cyberpunk's battle for freedom of the internet, what is the purpose of it? You know, why do we have to free the internet? It's for the sake of just to have a free internet for that we can just be free on the internet? Or is it something bigger? And for me, you know, again, I always come back to Julian Assange's philosophy and his idea and what he stood for and fought for and sacrificed his life, is that he looked at internet as fundamentally a tool for emancipation of humanity. So it's a tool to emancipate, the tool to liberate humankind. So it's, again, you know, I think the question of can we liberate ourselves from Bitcoin is really like to recognize Bitcoin as a tool. And then, you know, don't give even our own power to this technology, you know, how much price goes up or how much that, you know, the Bitcoin becomes, yeah, like accepted and then become mainstream or whatever, but never give our power to this technology and use it as a way to, way to defend what is important to us, which is, I think, who we are as humans. So, and then again, that's, I think, a reminder. I think I want to remind myself of this all the time, that the me being a part of liberation psychologist, I guess, is not to have any attachment to anything, you know, and any identities or anything, but to always connected with something that is living, something alive, something constantly changing and moving within ourselves, that, you know, the what makes us human, you know, the creative force that actually give birth to Bitcoin itself, that, you know, to stay, remain connected to that force, I guess. I think that's kind of requires a practice and discipline to live in that way, to always be, you know, always remember that, you know, real creative force that is within ourselves.
Yeah. This conversation has been completely fascinating for me. I really recommend people, you have a slew of articles on Bitcoin and freedom and money as a trust-based, money being trust-based. I recommend people definitely check out all your articles. This book to me is fascinating. WikiLeaks, The Global Fourth Estate, History is Happening. I really think it should just be called History is Happening because that's what it really captures for me. And I really like the angles and the things you dive into. You know, I think WikiLeaks is sort of a platform to explore these topics. And you explore them in a way that is just completely fascinating to me and that I really enjoyed. I hope to have you on again sometime, but definitely let people know where they could find you, where they could find your articles, your writings, and your book.
Oh, sure. So you can find me, my work on at nozomihayase.com, that's my name, and .com. And or you can always follow me on Twitter, Nozomi Majin. And I would ask you to maybe put the link on in the description part, the Julian Assange's, the official WikiLeaks campaign site that help us understand Julian's situation, legal situation, and ways to free him. So if you don't mind, I would ask you to just put the link.
Yeah, I will definitely, I've been really lazy with links, but I will definitely try to remember to keep that one on. It's definitely an important issue and cause. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I do hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you so much.
Nozomi Hayase on how Bitcoin affects our connection to reality, instincts, and natural law right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you were down in Miami for the conference this past weekend, I hope you had just as incredible time as I did. The highlights are too many to list here, but I'm already looking forward to BitBlock Boom in August. In the meantime, keep learning, keep stacking, keep going, and keep your head on straight, and stay in the game. This one's for keeps. Peace.